But then the fall was really hard because then you go, oh, I'm 27, I'm a complete failure. You know, what do I do now? And my dad wrote me a letter, which I think is the only letter he ever wrote to me in his life, telling me, this is everything that you've done. You've launched a business, you've done this. And yeah, of course, at the end of the day, it didn't work. But these are all this is what value you've created for yourself.
Yes.
And it was amazing. And I kept that letter. I still have it. My dad passed away many years back, but that letter stayed with me.
From Foundation Capital, this is How to B2B a CEO, the show about how to scale your enterprise startup and how to grow from founder to CEO. I'm Ashok Garg, general partner at Foundation Capital. So this episode is airing just a few days after Anaplan went public and has a market cap of over $3 billion. Anaplan provides software for business planning and performance management. And as luck would have it, we have with us today Frederic Laluyo, who is the CEO of Anaplan and took the company from less than $1 million in revenues to over $100 million in less than 4 years. Frederic is a serial entrepreneur who started his first company in France at the age of 23 and is currently the CEO of Era Technologies. Frederic is one of the most astute thinkers at the intersection of business and talent that I have ever met. Over the next 30 minutes, Frederic walks me through his remarkable career and the lessons he has learned about how to scale a company. Thank you, Frederic, for joining us today. I'm really excited to have you on my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your story and how you got started.
How much time do you have? make the story short, did a very interesting training program in business school with a company in the US, got to know people, and right I came back when I was done with my military obligation, I launched a first startup, and that's the time where the word startup didn't really exist in France. So I had to find money to launch this company called Transcribe Technology that was making a device called the Penvox, which was really cool EDI technology. They pushed it for 4 years. I think we spent about $3 million at the time, which was a lot. It was literally in a garage.
Wow.
in the suburbs of Paris. Learned a ton, did a lot of good stuff. But the thing called the internet kind of came in the way and made basically the entire space irrelevant. Cost of transaction went down, and you know, you could use a simple PC to do a lot of the things that you used to do with those very expensive EDI terminals or with our technology on the lower end. So realized along the way that hardware was hard and that the software thing seemed to be a lot smarter, and decided...
Just to interrupt for a minute, so just
sure.
Closing the story on Transcribe. So did you end up winding the company down?
Totally.
Complete. What was that experience like?
I think about it, 20-something, you're doing this, you get a lot of coverage, a lot of press. I was one of the very first to launch a commercial website in France along that. So you feel really, really high. The one thing that's not working is the revenue. So everything looks so good. My friends were very impressed. You know, after business school, everybody goes and work for, you know, KPMG or McKinsey or whatever, and I decided to go in a garage in the burbs of Paris and do a startup. And, you know, they looked at me like strange, but then it looked pretty good.
Especially as a tomorrow.
But then the fall was really hard because then you go, oh, I'm 27, I'm a complete failure. What do I do now? And my dad wrote me a letter, which I think is the only letter he ever wrote to me in his life, telling me, this is everything that you've done. You've launched a business, you've done this. And yeah, of course, at the end of the day, it didn't work. But these are all this is what value you've created
these
for yourself.
Yes.
And it was amazing. And I kept that letter. I still have it. My dad passed away many years back. But that letter stayed with me. And it gave me the confidence to go back. And instead of taking a regular job in a big company, I decided to launch the European operation of a British software company called Armstrong Lang at the time. They built very smart activity-based costing software. Started discovering what unpriced software was, selling to big companies. Anecdote was the first time I was in front of this buyer purchase department from this big insurance company selling off my first software, still floppies at the time.
Yep.
The guy says to me, so why do I have to pay 80,000 francs for the two floppies? And I didn't know what to say. Went back and my boss said, Well, go back and give him two floppies. And then you say, if you want to code on them, it's 80,000. And I did it. And I was a little scared, but it worked. So it was a really, really a set of 4 or 5 years of heavy duty formation, going technical on the product, understanding how to implement it, how to sell it, do pre-sales, recruit my first folks. And I did that very well. So
sounds like a great start, but this transition to selling enterprise software for the first time is always a hard one. For most founders, you know, who had a product background or some of the functional background, what were some of the learnings? I mean,
I was hungry, and I worked really hard. Honestly, I was on my own having to learn. The first time I ended up in a conference in front of 300 CFOs talking about the topic of finance and how to calculate cost and profitability, I mean, I was half a page ahead of them on the books, right? I mean, it was literally, I worked day and night. I remember doing some 8 to 10 hour long presentations in front of 30 people. These were big software, and spending the whole night in my crappy hotel building the model for the next day. But I loved it. I mean, it was an adventure, it was fun, and it worked. So for the first time, you know, the company was making money, I was making money. It felt good. You know, it was like, wow, we're winning. And the profile of the company grew. So I think you have this passion in you or you don't. I just loved it. Then in 2002, I came to the US with Liz to restructure the US division of that same company that was not doing well. And after 3.5 years of very, very hard work with some really great people, we had rebuilt a team and a company that did very well and ended up being sold, my dear regret, to Business Objects. So Business Objects were the best acquirer we could find, but selling the company at that time was, in my opinion, a big mistake.
It was your baby. And
I feel like when you finally catch a wave in a market and you feel like you're finally getting your $1 million deals, it's not the right time to sell. It's the right time to milk the cow. You work so hard to find that wave, to find that moment where you find a bit of pull in the market, where your brain becomes something that people relate to, that, you know, if you sell at that point, well, I understand the board, they've probably written the asset off already and suddenly they could make their money back. And why would they trust a crazy French dude in Atlanta? Anyway, I'm not blaming them. But the point is, it was stupid. In my opinion, you can never redo the past, but it was a bad decision. The one thing that I've learned is when you survive for so many years with a very smart technology, incredible talent. I mean, I've got some of the engineers from that company working at Era today.
Wow.
And the most brilliant guys. I don't want to say too loud because I don't want him to hear that. But the point is, you learn execution excellence because you have no choice. You don't have capital. You have to make payroll. You have to win every deal. And you learn how to work hard and win because there's no other option, right? So that being raised, so to speak, professionally, being poor, is stuck with us. I mean, Business Objects was a phenomenal company. I did 5 years at SAP, incredible experience, and then incredible ride with Anaplan. But we still go back when we talk about ourselves.
Go back to where it all started off.
Yeah, and I keep saying, remember when we were poor. When we remember that you didn't have VC money and you had to actually, you know, hit payroll and win. And every deal, like, okay, we got to make that 60K deal. Otherwise we can't pay the bills.
And then tell us about the Anaplan story. I mean, you were a very successful and senior executive at SAP.
Yeah.
And to go from there to a startup again wasn't the obvious thing.
It became the obvious thing. You're right. It wasn't the obvious thing, but it became the obvious thing when I was at SAP, when I was there. I learned a lot of stuff. I learned, how to run a much larger, it was very big business that I had the chance to work on, learned the politics, learned the methods, the tools. It was a very good formation for me. But while I was there, I was also looking at, you know, what am I doing next? So I said, okay, now look at startups, right? And then I realized that when a startup looks for a new CEO, it's usually because it's completely, completely broken. It's usually a product looking for a market, or a market without a product, or a Series Z and you know, a massive, complex politics environment. until I found that tiny weenie company called Anaplan that just had like 25 people or something like that between York and San Francisco. But what basically Anaplan at the time had built starting in 2006. So the ALG chapter of my life was closed in 2006, and we had a very clear roadmap on how to take the technology to 64-bit and so on and so forth and build bigger cubes and all this stuff. And then fast forward 2012, I meet these guys, and what they've basically done starting 2006 is build exactly the same technology.
So build the roadmap that you had laid out.
They had literally built the roadmap that we had laid out. And there is no secret, right? Because those guys and us were, you know, in parallel. So they were all coming from a company called Adata, and we were coming from a company for ALG. So we knew each other. And they just did that thing. And
so you were the perfect CEO for Anaplan.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer for me. I don't know how big it's going to get, but I knew I couldn't screw it up because there was always, I knew in about 30 seconds. And off we went. And fast forward close to 4 years, $100 million in revenue. Last year, we booked $150 million.
Wow, so almost zero to $100 million in 4 years.
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. In ARR, and 650 people, I think, when I left, 16 countries. We built a company from. So the playbook was actually interesting, right? And I remember meeting with the CEO of a big company that has a big tower now in the city, telling me, he said, "What's your strategy?" I said, "Well, we're going global first. We're going as a platform. And we're going after large enterprises. Large enterprise, platform, global." And he says, "You should be going small, local, and pointed use case." My answer to him was like, "Yeah, but there's something called the cloud that you help build that now allows us to actually think very big and execute." So the plan was, when I joined, I said, by the end of the year, we'll book $10 million. And they all looked at me going like, "You're not at SAP anymore, you're crazy. We did more than that." The end of that first year, I said, "We're going to now operate like a $100 million company." And I had Cartesis in mind, which is a company I'd run for 1 year when I was with Business Objects. And I defined what it meant to operate like a $100 million company. And at the end of that year, without disclosing all the numbers, but we were on track to be, you know, our last quarter was showing that we were on track to do that. And at the end of that year, I remember being in Tahoe somewhere thinking, well, what's my next story? And I struggled and I was like, well, what's after 100 million? So within 10 million, 100 million, the next logical step is a billion. And I was like, how do I build a billion-dollar revenue company? And I scratched my head for quite a while, and I had this moment where I was like, okay, what is a billion? It's 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000. That's pretty simple, right? So I call this the 1K cube strategy. And it's, if I can get to 1,000 companies with 1,000 users paying $1,000 per user, I get $1 billion revenue, not value, right?
Yeah.
Company.
The math works. It's a little.
And then I said, how many customers do we have? 263. How many users do we have per customer, whatever the number was, and what's the average deals what's the average price per user, 987, whatever the numbers were. I just don't want to. And I said, okay, so how do I build a strategy to actually go to 1,000 here, 1,000 there, and protect my 1,000 there? And it became all obvious.
We'll be right back.
If Albert Einstein had worked in human resources instead of quantum physics, he would have said that hiring is hard. Not as hard as the general theory of relativity, but way harder than the special theory of relativity. I mean, come on. It would have been obvious to an HR professional as brilliant as Einstein that getting the best people is the difference between being a great company and a mediocre one. That's why Einstein would have loved Eightfold. Eightfold is the most effective way for companies to identify promising candidates, engage talent, reach diversity goals, and retain top performers. Businesses using Eightfold's talent intelligence platform have been able to achieve 7 times higher candidate responses, 80% faster hiring cycles, and 60% lower cost to hire. That's why Eightfold would have been Einstein's favorite talent management tool, and that's why it should be yours too. Eightfold improves hiring. Visit eightfold.ai to learn more.
I want to go back to that 1-0-10 story. What are the one or two lessons you would share for first-time founders who've never had that, who've never seen that movie before?
Well, having been the guy who didn't find it the first time, literally, first company, I just didn't find any money. The second, it took us a long time to get to the 10 million. And then I would say with Anaplan, we got fortunate, and Era is even faster now. But you need to find a wave to ride. I mean, the challenge is that you can't create a wave. If you're a very good surfer and you're in the ocean and there are no waves, you can't surf. So the number one thing you have to do is to make sure that you are resolving a problem that people are willing to pay, and you have to test that. If you can't test it, and you just think that it's a problem that people will want to resolve, yeah, everybody wants to resolve a problem, but it's a question of prioritization. Whether it's consumer or enterprise, where you get a traction is when people prioritize your problem over others. So a lot of entrepreneurs that I coach, they go, oh, look, this is a great problem, and it's undeniable that this is a problem. But the next question is this a problem that people are willing to resolve? And the answer might be yes, and you're still not there. Is this a problem that people are willing to resolve over other problems? And that's
the key.
And then it's a question of timing. With Armstrong Lang ALG, at one point when the economy was booming, people didn't really care about cost management and profitability analytics. They cared about growth. And we were like, wouldn't it be fantastic if you could have real-time visibility into your product channel customer profitability and say, yeah, that'd be great, but right now I need to find a way to spend my money and grow. And then
so
suddenly,
I think it's the nail on the head. I think it's this core thing that for so many entrepreneurs, analytically, it makes sense that
to always
solving a real problem.
Yeah.
But find a real problem, make sure you're solving it, and then make sure it's a solution that they value at that point in time.
Yeah.
And they value it more than the other things they could be doing.
The second thing I would say, so that's the number one, in my opinion, because that's my wave, right? If there is no wave, you can't surf. But the second thing is you can even surf a little wave for a while, but it's about identifying the profile of the people that you're going to be selling to. And I can relate that to Era. We are hyper, hyper innovative. So most of the companies in my career were focused on removing pain. For a while we called us the spreadsheet killer. Spreadsheet equals pain. Whether it's ALG or what we did with SAP or Anaplan, it was a lot of like, we're going to take your existing spreadsheet mess and bring a better product so that you don't have all this pain. But the real exciting is when you start thinking about, my company is not about removing pain, it's about creating value. It's about foraging into an area that's never been explored. And for
it's
that,
a shift in your career, because the arc of the curve has always been about sort of this pain reduction.
But that's deliberate. I was tired of pain reduction. I was all about now the next story. And that's the difference between what will become a $50 billion market cap or what can become a $5 billion market cap. I think that's, to me, I define the difference there. There's only so much money that people are willing to pay for removing pain, right? But if you create value, if your technology can really impact the top line in a significant manner, then the floodgate opens.
Then the sky's the limit.
The sky's truly the limit. And you see a few of these companies doing that out there, and they're the leaders. The second point is on execution. You have to be realistic about what you can do, but if you find an opportunity, you have to really now focus on execution. I've learned a huge lesson with ALG. We had built a wonderful technology that could have become the size of Anaplan. We just forgot to milk the cow. Meaning, if you're able to resolve the problem of one company successfully,
yep,
with your 20K software, your 50K software, whatever level of subscription you want, you have to stop and say, why did they buy this? What happened? And what problem am I resolving? And then say, My only goal now is to find another one like this and another one like this.
The repeatability. That
you Whereas when you're an entrepreneur and you live in that world of you're trying to tackle the SAPs and the Oracle, you think that by over-innovating, you're going to win. And it's not that. As soon as you find one use case, one opportunity to make real money, legitimately, and derive value for your customer, then you stop and you say, I'm not innovating anymore. I'm fixing the bugs, I'm fixing the problems, but I need to milk the cow. And then you go to the next step, and then you go to the next step. And I think Anaplan did incredibly well in the early days by applying that strategy. Say, hey, here's one use case we have. So you have your big vision, you know,
then you have to go
$100 billion, blah, 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 the platform story, the skills, all of the, or at the time we called that apps, I think they still do, all of that. But the execution is incredibly methodical, one by one, understanding your market and not being delusional. So you can be delusional in your vision, but you have to be incredibly hardworking, pragmatic when it comes to execution. And the early days of a company, people buy from people, they're the pioneers. Your clients will be risk takers in those big companies if you're selling to large enterprise, which was my case all my career. And those pioneers are incredibly demanding, sometimes unfair, doesn't matter. They will take risk with you. They will love you too much, as I always say. And then at some point they will hate you and then they will love you again. And it's this kind of tension that's great. But then you kind of cross the chasm and it's your brand that takes over and you're changing your relationship with the next wave of clients when you start hearing people say, oh, it's easy to sell this. Really? Well, you just came in 3 years late because I tell you the first 3 years, it wasn't easy. But the momentum is such that now people want to buy this brand. And at that point, they don't even know why they want to buy the brand. But that's what they want to do. Okay. You have to be aware of all those steps and you have to architect your organization toward that.
So talk more about that. I mean, the shift from being, you know, in the early days, you're pushing. You're pushing and it can often feel like you're pushing rope. And then at some point, you know, when the brand takes over, you get this pull,
yeah.
That incredible pull that comes from the market. And every entrepreneur dreams of that. The challenge, as you rightly said, is, you know, you start going after 3 or 4 different use cases, you're dispersing your limited resources across a lot of different things. As soon as something starts to work, you know, sometimes the best technical founders want to go find the next use case versus milk the cow.
That's the problem of most.
What advice do you give them to sort of manage that chaos internally? How do they streamline execution?
I can't really phrase it differently. You just have to stop. When you make your first one or two deals and listen to your clients, the recipe is build your brand, start your first hire, make sure you hire people who are good at selling to the pioneers. There should be uncontrollable salespeople with incredible genius and ability to understand and really articulate your vision. I call them, you're the CEO and I'm not there. And then, you know, build a solid team and fight like crazy to get to the first customer. And once you have that customer, fight, stop everything, fight like crazy to make them successful. And do not worry about the rest. And once you have this, then you worry about the next step.
Any advice for founders as they're thinking about how does construct a board as they think about how to sort of bring investors on board? What questions should they ask?
So everything I say now is going to sound like, well, of course you should choose your board members and you should choose your investors. Well, most people don't choose. They hope and they get one and they're happy because they get the check. So the ability through the check to continue to pursue their endeavor and their dream. And so, yes, of course, in an ideal world, when you are in a fortunate position, like I was with Era, to literally raise as much money as you want with the best people, you can, you know, I can give lessons now. But it hasn't always been the case. So, I mean, in hindsight, I would say that I personally prefer to work with investors that have been practitioner and not just pure quote-unquote bankers. Because I think when you work with people who've been through that dance, who've been on your shoes, and they understand how difficult it is to grow a company from zero to 1,000 in a record time and perform as you do that without a safety net. They appreciate that you get tired, that you make mistakes, but you're still there. Whereas if you've just been someone distributing money and collecting money, and full respect for that, you might be the best investor in the world. It doesn't make you the best board member. So my point is you have to assess whether you're talking to an incredibly shrewd investor, but that doesn't make this person a good board member, because you define a good board member not when everything goes well. You define a good board member when the company is underperforming, when you are in trouble as a CEO, or when the company is under attack. So that's when you define the character of a board member as opposed to an investor. And I think the challenge in Silicon Valley right now is that you have a lot of incredibly smart investors who are just terrible board members, either because they're just bad at it or because they're just too busy. So
I think that's very well said. You know, one of the things at Foundation we always try to do, and it's hard, is we tell ourselves that we want to be the first phone call a CEO makes when shit hits the fan.
Yeah, and that's,
that defines who you are.
That's exactly right. I think the other thing that you need to do is to make sure that you're not the only gem in a portfolio, because then you become people's retirement plan, and that drives your board members to behave as individual investor caring about their house at Tahoe or whatever, as opposed to am I representing the entire shareholder base, and am I doing my job as a shareholder, as a board member, or as an individual investor, so to speak? Am I becoming too big, basically, for the company that I took the money from at one point as in the journey? The one thing I would say as well is, and it took me a while because I came in Silicon Valley, I was 42 years old already, but I think it's incredibly important to have a network of people that you know and trust that have no vested interest in your company whatsoever, either a board member or investor or colleague. I mean, I have incredibly tight relationship with the folks at Era, my both board and my team, but I do find it incredibly helpful and useful to be able to chat with a friend, with a CEO of another company, with an investor, because you need that, right? So you shouldn't rely only on your board to be that sounding board when you are a CEO. You need to have your own network of folks. Anthony Reynolds, who worked with me at Anaplan as CEO, and incredibly smart guy, and it just started that dinner, you know, it's like four or five of us getting together and just chatting, and you can talk about anything you want. Yeah. And that's brilliant. You need a lot of that time, and you need to make that time while you're working 18 hours a day.
And I think that's great advice. And as you said, you have to make the time.
It's impossible.
There's always something else to do.
It's hygiene. It's the CEO hygiene. I mean, you have to go for your run or do your yoga or whatever you want. But if that's for your personal hygiene, but your CEO hygiene, you need to have those conversations, and you need to hear what people say to you. Because your board will be, when the company gets too big, you know, they think about, you know, what's in it for them, as opposed to what's in it for your vision, for your company, or for yourself. And they won't call bullshit on you. They'll pull the plug, but they won't. There's politics in a board.
In particular, for technical founders, it's hiring the first few business executives is hard. They've never hired business people. You know, one of my founder CEOs said, you know, the challenge of hiring salespeople is even an average salesperson can sell himself or herself better than I can. Figure out if they're good or bad.
That's true. And there are a lot of people good at that in Silicon Valley, for sure. A lot of people, executives saying, well, I was at that company, I was at Salesforce, so I was at this and I was that. And when you're young, you get impressed by that. And
yeah.
I'm like, well, hold on. You know, if that doesn't mean anything, right? So you work for a company at a point in time, but doesn't mean, even if you were an executive, but you worked underneath that executive, that CEO, you know, you have to identify who really is the engine for a vision for execution in a company. And you have a lot of tug-along people that then move to a smaller startup.
And they're in the right place, right?
Exactly. And I've been on boards and I advise a lot of you know, entrepreneurs, and they say, oh, this guy is coming from that company. I was like, what was he doing there? That means nothing. I'd rather be very careful with that, right? Or people that work come from a giant company and say, well, I built, my division was like a startup. No, there is no such thing as a division that's like a startup within a company that hires 10,000 people. That's BS, right? So my advice is, you know, define, look for the character. So first of all, write down what you want. I need a salesperson that has that profile that will be able to be scrappy. And then, so, right, so that's what you want. Then go for it, but don't expect that person to be the best at filling up the forms that you want that person to fill. So you have to be realistic.
Make choices, make trade-offs.
And usually, and when you come from that very technical background, you're not used to that. You know, I want you to fill up the form. Well, no, because you want the scrappy salesperson to be able to sit in the lobby of that company for 4 hours until they grab the executive out of the elevator and talk to them. So there is usually a level of irrealism, a lack of realism of what you really, what people are really good at. And I think the key for a team is to leverage for people for what they're good at. And as an entrepreneur, you have to know what you suck at. And then find people that work, that are good at what you're not good at. And the other thing I would say is don't hire people that you like at first sight. What we do is so hard that you want the comfort of, oh, that I just met this candidate. We hit it off so well. Well, that's kind of your story of your rep that's so good at schmoozing you. But the reality is you're going to be working with this person a lot, and find people with the depth and the character that are maybe a bit awkward, maybe a bit off, but have that angle, that edge that you need in a startup. People that are hyper-polished will not usually have that edge. Then you'll see that you build that relationship over the years, and then the loyalty builds up both ways, and then you end up having an incredible journey together. And those are life-defining journeys. It's a little bit more complicated to go with the right people as opposed to the easy people. And I think what we do is so hard that we tend to go after the easy people. The profile being impressed by a big company, you know, or a sharp-looking person or whatever, you know, a good resume. But listen to your guts and then know yourself, right? I need someone who's not like me, who's going to piss me off on those decisions, but will do the right thing.
That's it for this episode. You can find past episodes and subscribe to future ones on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. How to B2B a CEO is brought to you by Foundation Capital, an early stage venture capital firm with 27 IPOs, including Netflix, Lending Club, TubeMogul, and Sunrun. I'm Arshu Garg, a general partner at Foundation Capital. I'm passionate about helping B2B entrepreneurs who are trying to solve hard problems. So if this podcast speaks to you, if you're interested in growing from a technical founder into a business leader, drop me a line. Thanks, and see you next time.